Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, August 7th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps in the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. It is Casual Friday, folks. Yet we are running early this AM. I will explain in a moment, but joining me on the program, Emma Vigeland of TYT. Also joining me, Lucy Steiner of AMQ. Meanwhile, as millions face eviction and diminished unemployment checks, the end of the Paycheck Protection Program and student loan deferrals, still no COVID relief plan. Half the Republican Party seems to have left the building anyway. Meanwhile, the DNC releases its list of speakers for the national convention, and the Postmaster General admits he's slowing the mail. Federal court strikes down Trump's methane rollback. Tax violations and proper spending, just some of the greatest hits in the NRA's soon-to-be demise. And Latin American massacre cheerleader Elliot Abrams is back and is now Donald Trump's envoy to Iran. Meanwhile, Louisiana Supreme Court upholds a black man's life sentence for stealing hedge clippers 20 years ago. And finally, Facebook employees claim that right-wingers were allowed to bypass fact-checking. Huh. All that and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen.
Are we having a problem with my mic? Is my mic a little bit hot?
Now it's better. Over the intro music, it sounded a little bit muffled, so we'll have to adjust that in the future.
Okay. Well, we should tell you right now, ladies and gentlemen, that I am in the Brooklyn studio today, just for the day, anticipating that we're going to be doing the show like this in September, where Matt and Brendan and Jamie and whomever is going to be out of studio. I will be in studio part of the time as I work out the logistics of both maybe sending my kid to school or maybe not, but also the logistics of custody logistics. So a lot of stuff there that you probably didn't need to know, frankly. But there it is. And so bear with us. If this morning was one of those mornings that Michael would have really enjoyed watching me lose my shit with technical stuff in the office. Matt and Brendan don't have the same appreciation for it that I think Michael did. But I'm sorry, guys. But the good news is that it's all remote. You can just mute your microphones as I'm throwing a fit over the technological challenges that we face, but we will get through it. So apologize if the sound quality is not as up to par as it usually is. I will tell you, though, I am in New York today because I am filling in for Chris Hayes on All In tonight. So tune in to All In tonight. Bernie Sanders will be one of my guests. And then I'm not sure who else is going to be on. We'll see. Let's get right into it. They've announced the DNC speakers. We'll talk about that. Our DNC coverage, we're still working out what we're going to do. We had a pre-planned vacation for the week that they have now moved the Republican convention to. And for a whole nother host of reasons, that vacation cannot be changed. And so we're going to figure out, I don't know, we're going to have obviously programming that day, but we're not necessarily going to cover the RNC. We're working on all that. I just wanted to give you a heads up for all this. You know, August is going to be a little bit weird. And then, of course, things are going to be weird. And then things will remain weird for the rest of the time. Who knows for how long everything is going to be weird. It's a weird time, folks. It's a weird time. Meanwhile, where the heck is my, now where's my sound? No, I can't find my sound. It's also weird working in the exact same setup for 3 months, 4 months, 5 months, then coming back into the office, which was a setup I was completely comfortable with. And then now feeling like I'm not comfortable in this setup because my monitors are in a different place and everything's a little weird.
You're like a baseball player at an empty stadium right now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It's very strange. It's very strange. Now, here's Donald Trump. The guy is really trying to find something about Biden that will stick because Biden has done a very good job of basically, like, it's not like this guy was a signature politician in the past. I mean, yes, people knew him for representing the interests of the credit card industry. And he was a bit of a blowhard and he would make some gaffes, but there was really, you know, beyond that, you know, corporatist, I guess, but it's not like Donald Trump is out there going to go like, we've got to hurt corporations. I mean, he can't say that. So what does he say? Well, I think he's found his hook about Joe Biden.
Because he's going to double and triple your taxes. He's going to do things that nobody ever would ever think even possible because he's following the radical left agenda. Take away your guns, destroy your Second Amendment, no religion, no anything, hurt the Bible, hurt God. He's against God. He's against guns. He's against energy, our kind of energy. I don't think he's going to do too well in Ohio. If he did, we'd have a big story. He's not going to do well. And, you know, I was in Texas the other day. I said, wait a minute. The other side is against guns. They're against oil and gas. They're against religion, Bible, God. How's he going to win Texas? How's he going to win Texas? So he's not going to win Texas. He's not going to win Ohio. Bob told me we're better now in Ohio than we were 4 years ago. I'll take the same victory, but I think we're better. So I just.
He had to remind himself he was in Ohio and not Texas there.
Right. Yeah. I mean, right. Ohio. Oh, I'm in the place where the governor couldn't show up because he got COVID. Joe Biden's against God. He's going to hurt God. You know what? Like, I for one, am thinking that maybe based upon all the crap we've gone through just in 2020, maybe God needs a little pushback. I mean, maybe
come on, man,
a little bit big for his britches or her britches. Come on,
pal.
Come on, God. Give me a break, God. He's really like, I wonder if that's going to stick. Like, how do you, like, I mean, can you imagine? I mean, like, I remember when Republican voters would say, like, I can't vote for Barack Obama. He's a Muslim. He's not even from this country. I want to see the Trump supporter who's going to say the words, Joe Biden's going to hurt God. He's going to hurt God. And I need to protect God from Joe Biden.
Yeah. All those times Biden said, bless me, Father, for I've sinned, it turned out he was mocking God.
Well, it wasn't just, he was probably lulling God into some false sense of security. So go in and hurt him or her. How do you hurt God? Like, I think he's probably honestly, is Joe Biden that powerful? Do you really want to set your opponent up as to be like, he's going to be like, is the next thing that Trump is going to say is like, he's too busy fighting the gods to deal with mere mortals.
It's like Hercules.
Exactly.
Thanos complex or something.
Exactly. Joe Biden's thinking too much in the other world. He's not thinking of our world. He's thinking of the gods' worlds because he's fighting gods there and he's going to hurt them. Yeah. And I'm just down here with the mortals. Like, it's just, and then I love how he mixes up like hurting God, hurting gas, hurting guns, guns and God and gas. I mean, I'm not religious per se, but
I feel like Trump is, I keep coming back to the image of like a toehold when you're on like a climbing wall or something like that. And Trump just keeps trying to go for like one toehold that keeps falling off the wall and being like dragged up slightly. It's just,
I know I'm going to take him on in terms of spirituality. That's going to work.
I mean, he can't even say like he can't even construct the criticism that he wants to criticize Biden from, like that he's not God fearing, which, you know, I don't know. I feel like does Joe Biden even go through like a half an hour without doing that cross thing?
Right.
He's bad for Bible, though.
Bad for the Bible.
Bad for the Bible sales. Bad. You're going to hurt God. Hurt him. Hurt her or him. Fracture her hip. God's hip. I'll tell you what, though. If Biden does hurt God, one thing that I would now recommend would be Sunset Lake CBD's salve. Because I have now recommended that salve to like multiple people. One, someone who had shingles, their back was killing them. Used the CBD salve from Sunset Lake. In fact, I sent it to him. Oh, nice guy. Using it for eczema now. Yeah, you're supposed to use it for like muscle pain, but I use it for like, I'm finding it's actually working on my eczema and on mosquito bites. That's just me. I don't know. Maybe it doesn't work for other people that way, but it does for me. Sunset Lake CBD, they are located just outside of Burlington in Vermont. They're originally a family-owned dairy farm that would provide dairy for Ben and Jerry's ice cream. They decided to diversify in 2018, start to grow hemp. They grow 100% pesticide-free hemp using only organic fertilizers. They work with the University of Vermont to implement regenerative agricultural practices. Crop rotation, cover cropping. I don't know what any of that stuff means, though. But they also, their minimum wage on their farm is $15 an hour. The employees own the majority of the company and they sell multiple CBD products that everybody, loves. For me, I am enjoying the 750 and the 1500 ml, is it ml? Whatever, tinctures. For sleeping, like I say, if I've got eczema, I put it on my eczema. The salve is made with organic beeswax and arnica. They have delicious gummy sour bears that are 1,000 meg CBD. They have CBD-infused coffee, which is delicious. And they've got Matt. Matt is the expert on the smokables. Matt goes crazy on the smokables. My sister does too, to be honest with you, but don't tell my kids.
Yeah, I mean, there's these Smalls here, which I highly recommend. It's a product line I wasn't aware of, but nice tiny little nuggets that you can put in your grinder alongside anything else.
There you go. You can put it inside your grinder along anything else. Wink, wink. Meanwhile, you can get 20% off at sunsetlakecbd.com using the coupon code LEFTISBEST. LEFTISBEST. I got an email here from... I don't have her name. I never use CBD. I thought I'd try it for my worsening arthritis in my fingers and especially my thumb joints. I had zero expectations. I was astounded at how quickly and dramatically it works. Pain goes down 60 to 70% within 15 minutes. Left is best. SunsetLakeCBD.com. You get 20% off. Check it out. Also, I talk about these guys all the time because every morning I have an interaction with them, not with them personally, but with their toothbrush. As you know, daily routines out the window. One thing that I have been able to maintain, the one thing that has actually been upgraded, Saul went and had a dentist appointment for the first time in 6 months. Well, probably more. It's been a year. No cavities. Do I attribute it to his Quip toothbrush? I don't know, but I do know that he brushes for a full 2 minutes because it's got a built-in timer. He loves the watermelon toothpaste that they send every 3 months when we're just about to run out. Good health starts with good habits. Quip makes it easy to do so. You're using your electric toothbrush. And they help you floss better, too. They got a great flosser thing. The Quip electric toothbrush has a timed sonic vibrations, 30-second pulses to guide a dentist-recommended two-minute routine. So it's one 30 seconds here, one 30 seconds there, one 30 seconds inside, one 30 seconds inside on both all four of your quadrants. Like I say, there's a downsized version designed for kids. Saul loves it. Mila has an adult version, of course. Paired with Quip's anti-cavity toothpaste, eco-friendly, refillable floss dispenser, you get all the ingredients teeth actually need. The Quip brush head toothpaste and floss refills are delivered on a dentist-recommended schedule every 3 months for just $5 each. Shipping is free. So you're basically getting a new head every 3 months, $5, new toothpaste. You never have to leave the house. Join over 3 million happy customers using Quip starting at $25. You are talking to one happy customer who has two kids who are also happy customers, plus my sister, California, has one. Her dentist told me to say thank you to me, which I appreciate. So if you go to getquip.com/majority right now, you get the first refill free. That's your first refill free at getquip.com/majority. Get, G-E-T. Quip, QUIP.com/majority. Quip, the Good Habits Company. We will put links to both of those ads in our podcast and YouTube description today. And now I would like to welcome to the program. She is the star of the Young Turks, or a star at the Young Turks. I don't know. I don't know what to say that. With the Young Turks, Emma Viglin, welcome back to the program.
Hey. How are you, Sam?
I'm doing well. That Young Turk studio is looking great.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's just a little bed and whatever. I took all the picture frames down. They're like in a stack over here. So very high tech.
Now, why'd you do that? You don't want any pictures in the background?
I don't know. Like right now I'm with my family. So it's not even me. It's just like other people. So I figured easier to just get rid of all the accoutrement.
I understand.
How you use it? Can you use that correctly? Yeah.
Accoutrement?
Yeah. I
mean, you can get away with that. You can definitely get away with that.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about this week, Emma. There was, aside from the general horribleness of everything, there was some sort of big bright spot for progressives anyways. And I'm talking about Cori Bush's win in St. Louis against a 10 term congressman who's apparently his dad had been in that same seat for 40 years or I don't know how many years before that, 30 years before that.
Well, it's over 50 years, I think. And he, you know, co-founded the Congressional Black Caucus. I mean, just a staple of Washington.
Right. And we're talking about Lacy Clay and then his father, I think Jim, this is a big win because it shows that it's consistent with the strategy, I think, that Justice Dems have been following and that progressive largely have been following. And there was a lot of organizations in there. Matriarch was in there very early. This was an original Justice Dems candidate in the last cycle. Matriarch got in there early this cycle to help out. Of course, Justice Dems did too. There was also support from No Monopolies. Bernie Sanders was the only federal elected official to endorse her, but Jamal Bowman, once he won his primary, he endorsed her as well. Give me a sense of, like, where does this take us in terms of the project of getting, you know, I guess the increasing the squad, as it were?
So I think there is obviously incredible good news to glean from this, but I will maybe just bring it down to earth for just a second, because I do think this makes it super clear what the path forward is, and the path forward is safe blue districts and just overwhelming safe blue districts with progressive candidates, and then making that so overwhelming that it then trickles down, ironically, to more purple districts, because they haven't had, progressives really haven't had success in terms of primaries there. The best, strongest progressives have come in really blue areas. And I think once you start to demonstrate that that's possible, then you can make inroads with more purple areas. But I mean, we saw Nabila Islam did not win her district down in Georgia, and just many other progressives, really great ones who are running throughout the country. So I think that's really where Justice Democrats has gone, and that's the direction they've gone in. And they've been a little bit more, they've shown more discretion when it comes to backing candidates in purple districts, and they've gotten criticism for that. But I do think it seems like it was the right way to go. And then another Debbie Downer point is, yeah, Bernie Sanders, the only one to endorse Cori Bush. Where was her friend Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who was featured with her and knocked down the House? And, you know, I think Ilhan Omar doesn't run from any fight, and she didn't endorse her either. So obviously Ilhan Omar has her own race to worry about, which is in a few days, I think. So I don't want to be overly critical there, but it's notable. It's just a data point, I guess.
Well, I mean, let's take both those, like, and start with the latter one first. To me, it's quite clear. It's a question of a walking a very fine line when it comes to dealing with the Congressional Black Caucus.
Yep.
And I mean, I think, like, and you know, there is the future of the Democratic Party, it seems to me, is going to be largely in the hands of women of color in key districts around the country. I mean, I think that's just, like, you know, we're looking at all the data now. Obviously, you know, there's going to be still some white people, still some men, and men of color, but women and people of color, black people, brown people, Latino, that's where the future of the party is going to be. And it's going to, you know, the Congressional Black Caucus, there is a presumption that you're talking about progressives, and it is not the case. And it's a lot of times, a lot of the members of the CBC are, they come from districts that are deeply blue, but they end up, In many instances, taking a lot of corporate money. I mean, I was on Up with Chris that weekend show, and got into a big fight with the, I don't know,
fifth wealthiest black guy in the country. This guy, Peebles or something.
Ron Peebles.
Yeah, Ron Peebles.
Right.
And we got into a fight about the estate tax. And his argument was, and I didn't know who he was. I mean, I'm just, you know, on a panel. I had no idea that he was, you know, wealthy or not. He just says to me, he goes, you know, the estate tax, that's a, you know, a done deal or whatever. And I'm like, whoa, no. And his argument was that, it, you know, we need to increase black wealth. And so we shouldn't have an estate tax. And I didn't realize he was talking about his own black wealth and his kids. But the CBC was supporting a basically blowing the lid off the state tax, more or less. I mean, maybe just making a much higher threshold. And you start to dig into this, you start to find out, you know, okay, they're taking a lot of money from wealthy folk, and they're you know, they're justifying it the way this guy Peebles does. And I think so there are pickup targets for progressives and leftists in districts that, you know, where the members are a member of the Congressional Black Caucus. And I think probably because, you know, Clay's dad was involved in the formation of that caucus. We're going to have times like this, and it's going to make for an uncomfortable situation for like members of the squad who want to endorse a challenger who would otherwise. But it becomes a little bit, it's a little bit tricky to do so in these instances. So,
well, just a quick, before I lose it, the point that you made about the point he made about the estate tax, that's like essentially the lean in argument for like increasing black wealth. No, we'll just join the wealthy and just try a little bit harder to be a part of that club of wealthy oligarchs. But, I think you're right. And Lacey Clay specifically was like weaponizing the race discussion when it came to the Congressional Black Caucus and talked about how Justice Democrat specifically was racist for targeting black incumbents. And then, you know, the Congressional Black Caucus turns around, endorses Elliot Engel in that race. Right. Jamal Bowman's a black man, and Lacey Clay, a black woman, was running against him and defeated him. Are you a sexist, Lacey Clay? I don't know. Many people are saying this.
Right. I mean, I think it's just, you know, it is just to make an explanation that, and people should be, you know, this is a good dynamic that's going to play out for a while, I think, over the next couple of cycles.
It's so disingenuous and dangerous because it's like the boy who cried wolf. When you keep using the tactic of race disingenuously, when racism is a massive problem, obviously it's hard to make good faith arguments when you have actors like that who are weaponizing it for their own like purely selfish electoral ends.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just an effective tool, on some level for them, but in this instance, definitely not. And so in that respect, it's good. And then the other point about blue districts. AOC was on the program a couple of weeks ago, maybe a month or two ago. And the strategy here that they have come around to is understanding is that A, you don't need the same resources, right? Because all you need to do is win the primary.
Right.
Jamal Bowman is going to win. Cori Bush is going to win. That's what's happening. And so, in that respect, you need to spend all the money and you can put all of the resources into the primary as opposed to saving some for the general or, you know, and you can spread out those donations across, the thing. And I think also the other point is that like, it's the blue districts that set the tone for what other districts, lawmakers can get away with, right? Because if Elliot Engel is voting a certain way, it gives a lot of license to someone who's in even like a purplish or even like a light bluer district. Well, this guy's in a heavily Democratic district. I can vote this way because, they're setting the standards.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, it's, I guess it's an Overton window type of argument on some level, but.
Well, that was the, that's kind of the exact phrase I was thinking of. It just, at least you have more people in the room who are making a argument. I mean, that's, it's really, that's how it what it comes down to. I mean, just in conversations about Joe Biden too, like I've been making this point, not to shift the conversation too far away, but just about how Joe Biden is politically probably to the right of Hillary Clinton, but he has more empathy. If there are people in the room, he'll listen, which is, I think, part of why Bernie Sanders is more enthusiastic about Joe Biden, I guess, than he was about backing Hillary Clinton, is because I think he does have a reputation of at least listening. So whoever is in the room is going to be so crucial to a potential Biden presidency. And we saw that too with his climate proposals and his infrastructure ideas. He has progressives in the room with him. So the policies do reflect that in a way that I think, you know, Hillary was more angry about making concessions and saw them as kinds of affronts, as opposed to Biden, who like doesn't have empathy if he's not around people. Like, he'll lock up black people or do, you know, the crime bill if they're not right immediately in front of him. But he is, you know, someone who does listen, which is a silver lining there.
Yeah, I would also say about Joe Biden, and I think that's a good point, is that he doesn't seem to have a plan.
Right.
I mean, like, you know, when he started to run, like, what was his agenda in running? His agenda in running was just to restore America's dignity. And, you know, that is pretty broad. I mean, as far as I can tell, yeah. He wanted to restore America's dignity, hurt God. Those are the two things that Joe Biden set out to do.
Right. Beat the heck out of God. Just pummel him in the face.
Rough him up a little bit. Show him who's boss. And restore American dignity. And then I think, like, he wins and then realizes, like, oh, I'm going to need a plan to do something here. And I think that's what we're seeing, is that there is, you know, Hillary Clinton came in. She had a massive machine that had been with her for decades. Joe Biden does not have that. He does not have that machine at all. And so there's this quality, and I keep describing it as like that scene, you know, that you see, like, there was probably multiple of these, like in Game of Thrones, but in any type of, like, where everybody is surrounding the king and the king's in bed and he's got consumption and he's coughing up blood and everybody are just waiting for him to die.
Yeah.
They're all vying to be the one who gets to be, you know, the new king or have the inside track to the next king. And that's the quality that's happening with Joe Biden, both metaphorically and maybe to some extent, literally.
Literally. But like with the VP race, that's that exact dynamic.
I mean, I'm trying to say this metaphorically, but, you know, it's hard to not have a literal vision of this as well. But, I mean, I think that's what's going on. There's a lot of people feeling like there's an opportunity here because Joe Biden doesn't have such a strong ideological or even technocratic plan. And so there's at least a perception that there's an opportunity for people to get in there and have some influence. Speaking of which, Larry Summers today announced will not join the Biden administration.
Wow. So, I did not see that.
That is, you know, one down, probably like about 900 to go.
Yeah, just replaced by all the Lincoln Project grifters who are like, we're doing these free ads for you for no reason.
Exactly. We just want to restore America's dignity.
Yeah.
We don't want a second bite at the apple here. But let's talk a little bit about, I don't know, let's talk about the VP thing. I just noticed they've also just released, you know, who's speaking at the DNC. Well, you know what? Let's play this clip just to round out the Cori Bush argument. I mean, segment, I should say. Let's just play this clip of her because this is super exciting. I mean, she was homeless. She was a Black Lives Matter activist in St. Louis.
I don't mean to downplay it. Like, it's one of the biggest progressive wins in recent memory.
And it's just like, to have a member of Congress who has had the experience of tens of millions of Americans,
right,
who never have a voice in Congress. This is a big deal. This is a really big deal in that respect. I mean, Jamal Bowman represents some of that as well. Like, this idea that we're going to have people who are having experiences that we have not seen in Congress, you know, that in terms of how many Americans they actually represent, I think, it, you know, I don't know how it's going to play out in real time, but it's going to be, I think it's going to be really important. And I imagine it's quite possible that we really can't imagine what difference it's going to lead to short, mid, and long term. Here's Cori Bush on MSNBC the other night.
Yeah. Well, you know, and your story is really moving. I mean, I was reading about the fact that, you know, at one point, you know, you had to leave your job. You're working in preschool education, lived in your truck, in your car for a while with your young children. You know, you've been through those kinds of struggles. As you said, you're a working class woman. Do you think that's what's missing in Congress? So many of those people are millionaires and multimillionaires. So many of them are not disconnected from the idea that $600 extra in your unemployment check could make all the difference in the world. That's something they can't relate to. Do you think the fact that you can relate to those kinds of struggles, do you think that that will make you a different kind of congresswoman? And in what way would you be different?
Yes, it will make me a different congressperson. I think that we need to have different people from different walks of life that represent our country. And so this district is, you know, we have a lot of poverty. We have, but we don't just have poverty. So we need people who can represent on different levels in Congress. For me, being someone who has lived out of my car, you know, let me tell you, that pain of the struggle that I've been through, I can still feel that pain right now. So that pain is walking with me into the doors of Congress. And that's what's going to feed me. That's what's going to fuel everything that I do. That, and then what I've seen the rest of the people in our community go through, how much we have had to fight. And when we're looking at what's happening in other places, it's like, why are we fighting so much? Why do we have to struggle so hard? Especially Black women in this community, you know, we're fighting so much. You know, where is the relief? Well, I'm ready to bring the relief. I'm ready to be that champion because I've been fighting this thing, unpaid fighting it, just because we need a different type of life. We need quality to our lives. We have to stop surviving St. Louis and start thriving here.
I mean, I think that's, you know, to me, that is it. And like, I don't even think, like, she doesn't even have to be too self-conscious about it, right? I mean, just the existence of someone in there who has had the life experiences she had makes her so unique in the context of Congress. And, you know, having two or three people in Congress who have that voice is, I don't know that we can actually anticipate what impact it's going to have. Like, you know, one of the big problems with money in Congress is that not just people being rich in Congress, but that money has access to Congress, is that like voices like Cori Bush's are completely shut out. And now that voice is going to be sitting in the congressional commissary and down the row and in the caucus meetings. And she's going to the amount of information I think that she's going to be able to give her colleagues, many won't care, but some will. And I think it's going to be, I think we can't really even predict the impact it's going to have.
You're so right. And additionally, beyond her life experience too, I mean, this is part of it, but I think we saw Rashida Tlaib bring some of this, but an activist background, like a specifically on the ground activist background, someone fighting for, and we saw this with, obviously, with civil rights leaders. John Lewis passed away most recently, but there are still two few and far between to have people who are passionate enough to take to the streets to fight for specific causes related to human dignity. And that's something that she represents as well. So beyond just her background, she was someone on the front lines of various fights, and it's huge. It's you can't overstate it. So I think you're dead on there.
It's going to be exciting. And when she, you know, I imagine, you know, and the thing that's nice too, is that she's going to come in there. She's going to have some allies. She's going to get up to speed in a way that, you know, one would not, you know, that you could, in another era, one could anticipate that if someone like that got into Congress, that they would probably be an island, but no, she's going to have support mechanisms. And, you know, the moral authority that she's going to be able to deliver when she gets up and, you know, people are talking about what working people need. Right. You know,
I'd love someone to try a bootstraps argument with Cori Bush. Let's see how the Republican, you know, millionaire from Tennessee who lives in a big house on a hill makes a bootstrap argument to Cori Bush. That'll be a fun sight.
It could be. I don't know. It could be super exciting. I'm pretty excited about it. The other thing this week, we have obviously mounting. We're about to, I think, hit into an era in terms of the COVID. I think for the next like 2 months or so, where we see it migrate into rural communities, poor rural communities where they do not have the infrastructure. So almost like the equivalent of what we saw in some urban areas, where, you know, the local public hospital has been either completely shut down or defunded in many respects. And we had higher rates of death in those areas because of it. In a state like New York, at least at one point, they were basically, you know, the resources were spread around a little bit, but still you can go and you can see the death rates were a function of what hospital you're at. When you're in rural, name the state, as it starts to spread into those areas, you've got hospitals without ICU beds. You've got no hospitals. You've got no infrastructure to transfer people in an emergency. You know, like you can't, if you've got, five or six people in there, you know, it's not going to work with Medivac. And it's just, there's no resources. We could see this now, migrate into, areas that there's just no way of helping them. And on some level, like, I don't know how much we'll even hear about it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I read an article this morning that just infuriated me about how in Q2, most health insurance companies, I'm forgetting the specific ones, but the giants doubled their profits as compared to last year. So you just see where the wealth is going. It's going to health insurers and certainly not being spread to rural hospitals. There are reports that rural hospitals are basically telling patients that are highest risk to just kind of go home and that they, if they can't help them, they just basically die there. I mean, that's the kind of healthcare that's being provided in these communities. It's terrifying. And this was completely predictable. I was reading articles in March about how rural hospitals just were not going to be able to deal with this. And all we got was screaming about how it's, you know, New York City and areas like that. And it was all New York's fault or whatever, but it spread. It was as predictable as it could be. And we're seeing the effects of it.
We're going to, we're also, still waiting for the numbers to get the sense of what actual numbers have been going on. I mean, there have been reports that since they converted from reporting to the CDC and instead to the White House via a private enterprise, that at least like the hospitals are convinced that there are big gaps in the data. The hospitals are convinced that there's undercounting that's going on. So we don't even know. And we're still talking well over 1,000 deaths a day. Still talking of, tens of thousands of new infections a day. We're at now over 160,000 people have died. Here is Tucker Carlson, bemoaning the fact that we have a even like a concept of public health. I mean, this is what is just this is just stunning to me. Here's Tucker Carlson, who I believe is like held up in Maine, in the most remote part of Maine now. He bought a studio up there, or he wanted to buy a garage. I read some story about it, and it was in the local press. So here's this guy who is like, why doesn't everybody just go up to their very remote Maine house instead of having, you know, some type of sense of public health policy?
First tip was their resolute refusal to admit where the virus came from. When strong evidence emerged from Chinese scientists that the disease originated in a lab in Wuhan, our leaders immediately and adamantly dismissed it as a conspiracy theory. They didn't want to know more. Their first instinct was to defend China. They didn't want the Chinese system discredited. That seemed confusing, but we soon learned why. The Democratic political activist Zeke Emanuel was among the first to reveal how the left planned to use the pandemic to change the United States. Here he is on MSNBC 4 months ago this week.
Realistically, COVID-19 will be here for the next 18 months or more. We will not be able to return to normalcy until we find a vaccine or effective medications. Is all that economic pain worth trying to stop COVID-19? The truth is, we have no choice.
Oh, the truth is, we have no choice. Except in a democracy, we always have a choice. That's why it's different
I just wanted to be like, you know, just catch up on what he's doing here, because he's making so many leaps here. It's fascinating. One, he's saying that the reason why the fact that it turns out not to be the case, but the reason why there was people were refuting that it came from a lab in Wuhan is because the Democrats wanted to transform America.
Yeah. Yeah, no, we have fealty and loyalty to the Chinese medical system. That's all the Democrats talk about. Progressives, it's Medicare for all, it's education, and Chinese labs. That's just, I can't get it off my mind. It's my number three or two priority, I don't know.
This is when Joe Biden was going to beat up God,
right?
He also was able to do something hinky with that lab in Wuhan. Like, what?
He got juiced up there. He got roided up at the Wuhan lab and then went to go sock God in the face.
But what? Like, I'm trying to think of like what, you know, because Tucker Carlson just like throws out these disparate things, right, that he knows will trigger his QAnon following or whatever it is. But what possible connection could there be between how the virus got started, either in a lab or in a wet market in China or whatever, and what the Democrats plan to do with it? And it also turns out 4 or 5 months ago that Zeke Emanuel was sounding a lot more correct than he probably did 4 or 5 months ago. Like, yeah, it's here. And when he says there's nothing we can do about it, that's just a fact of the disease.
No, democracy will stop it. We live in a democracy, so we can just vote out coronavirus. And he's right. The founders knew this. They knew it. God, those smart white men.
That's right. Where's the vote on whether we should still have the virus? Here, continue.
Oh, the truth is, we have no choice. Except in a democracy, we always have a choice. That's why it's different from an autocracy. In a democracy, on the big questions, the public gets to decide what the public wants. The people rule. That's the whole point of the American system. But the left had no plans to let the public decide anything. So instead, they issued resolute decrees. Remain at home. Wear a mask. Do not congregate with others. No one asked voters what they thought about any of this. Democracy played no role in it. The orders came down. Men with guns enforced the orders. The government used sophisticated technology to track down anyone who disobeyed them.
Pause it for one.
Just like this
fucking lunacy is unbelievable.
Yeah.
First off, are we supposed to have a referendum on this stuff? Because if we want to have a referendum on this stuff, have it. 80% of the fucking population says wear a mask. Like the president of the United States did not want to, was against masks, was trying to subjugate his own medical establishment, and the American people basically punished him for it. And that's why they changed their tune. Like, how did the left manage to do all the shit that he's talking about?
And who are the men with guns? Who, like, the men with guns right now are being sent by Trump to squelch protests in Portland and other cities. Like, I don't understand. Does he recognize who controls the federal government? He's evoking imagery of, like, paratroopers coming through and making sure you wear a mask, when the only equivalent thing that's actually happening there is Trump doing that to Black Lives Matter protesters. Because there's no, like, what is he even drawing on there except for that exact happening? That's what's happening right now.
The only other place that there's been guns has been like those white paramilitaries showing up at the state house in Michigan. And, you know, if he's so concerned about democracy, I mean, we could have a vote, but people don't want to vote because they don't want to go out because it's dangerous in terms of the disease that he apparently doesn't think is real. But he can take a look at the favorability ratings of Gretchen Whitmer. He could take a look at the favorability ratings of DeSantis, who went the other direction. I mean, we can do this all day. By any measure other than having some type of plebiscite, which nobody wants to engage in, which also contradicts his point, this is what the American people want. They want to be protected from the virus. And he has created this complete narrative that, I mean, you know, and I guess the reason why I'm getting so mad about it is there are people ostensibly on the left who continue to praise this guy, who is a not just a liar, not just craven, not just doing this to amass power. And I don't know why he doesn't need any money. It's disgusting. It's disgusting to give this guy any type of credibility when he goes out and spews this type of lies that will get people killed, that has gotten people killed.
But he only, it's the comfort of theory. So he's in the comfort of his main home or whatever, but it's also just, you can make any argument when it's just purely theoretical. And so he connects all of these things that are not rooted in any fact. And there are all of these right wingers that do this. Ben Shapiro is infamous for this, where he talked about how empathy has no place in, shouldn't have any place in politics. Well, you know, you're like a poli-sci sophomore that's just operating in some sort of book, and you're not looking at things on the ground. And that's what Carlson's doing there, except the end result is killing people. Killing his elderly audience that loves him and listens to what he says.
Well, they know he knows they're staying inside. They are staying inside because they also don't want to die. Right. But they just, I don't know. Maybe they're just not critically thinking about this stuff. Is there any more? Play a little bit more and we'll just let him finish his.
That's the end of it. That was the end of it.
I mean, it's just, I don't know why I get that mad about it, but it is. I think it's because this perception that somehow he's a truth teller.
Yeah.
And I'm sorry.
It bothers me too, because it was like a burrito of like non sequiturs and nonsense. Like, he connected and threw in so many things that didn't make any sense and are not existing in reality, and then came to a specific conclusion that was also nonsense. Like, usually on Fox, they'll take one premise or current event and then skew it in the wrong way. But he took eight and just put them all together to reach just such a BS conclusion. There's no way he actually even believes that.
Not at all. No, I know for a fact. I mean, I know for a fact that at least during the Iraq war, he had no compunction going on CNN, arguing in favor of the invasion, and then walking out the back door, having a cigarette and saying, like, I don't care about this at all.
Yeah. No, well, now he's a paleo conservative who really hates anti-intervention. Him and Tulsi Gabbard together, just two peas in a pod.
He is one of the worst, I think, in terms of just like sheer cynicism. Like, Sean Hannity, he's a lunatic and he's an idiot. But he actually believes it. He's like one of those end timers. I'm not saying this to his credit, but Tucker knows exactly what he's doing. And you can go back.
He's smarter than Sean Hannity.
He's much smarter than Sean Hannity.
Yeah.
And you can go back to his speech in front of CPAC
And I don't know when this was, but he got up in front of CPAC and said, conservatives don't have genuine journalists. We need to, this is how he was starting the Daily Caller, I guess it was. We need to have real journalism to compete in the journalistic world. And he got booed. He's, you know, he got booed by the people there. And then I think like it took him like 3 or 4 months to realize like, yeah, that's not going to work. I'm going to go back to, and then you could, the trajectory is just amazing to go back and look at. This is like where, this is where he needs, somebody needs to do a biography of this guy, actually. Sit down with Blake Neff and have some in-depth reporting as to what's Blake Neff doing these days. What happens when you are when you've reached the pinnacle of writing for a white supremacist on TV? Like, do you now got to go just like, do you start writing for OWN or something like that? What happens with that guy?
Start, maybe he'll join the Ellen DeGeneres writing crew or whatever's going on over there.
And he's just putting like little Easter eggs in her scripts.
Yeah.
Emma, as always, a real pleasure. I want to talk to you about the post office, but there'll be, I guess maybe we'll have time to do that in the future. Always a pleasure. Where can folks find you?
Just youtube.com/RebelHQ, facebook.com/RebelHQ. I post every work day. I take weekends off, guys. And you can watch my commentary on current events right now, because usually thought I was going to be on the road this year. That is not the case anymore. So not much on the ground coverage at the moment, but hopefully soon. Probably not.
Probably not.
Emma,
always a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Yep. Thanks so much. Bye.
All right, folks. And now do we have Lucy Steiner on the program?
She'll be joining us shortly. Yep.
Oh, shoot. We just lost Bernie for tonight on MSNBC.
Oh, damn.
Technical issues. Son of a gun.
He's probably having the same kind of freakouts you have.
That's right.
It's like, God damn it. Where's that cable at?
Damn it. Can't find it. Oh, that stinks. Darn it. I don't know what we're going to do. Hey, Lucy. She can't hear us.
It looks like she's still connecting to audio, but we have her video. Let's see.
Her setup. Wow.
Nice setup, yeah.
Lucy, can you hear us?
Oh, she can't hear.
Nope. Still connecting to audio. Can she? Can
you be joined?
Yeah, no, she has to hit her mic or join with computer audio. So.
Wow, she has a great system.
Oh.
Looks. Are you there? Can you hear us? All right, we can't hear you though. Yeah. But your audio, your whole set systems looks great. What do you got in the back? Is that a weight? Do you have weights in the back there too?
let's see.
There's a real comedian we got.
Oh, Lucy, she can hear us.
Lucy's going to mime everything that she has for us today.
Let's see. I see. So her mic is connected, but when she talks, it doesn't look like it's coming through. So
I'm seeing her being muted.
Yeah.
Well, she muted herself, I think. And now when she tries to talk, nothing comes out. So I think input.
Your
wrong input.
Go into your Zoom and your Zoom preferences. Hit preferences, folks. This is also something you should know for at home business. So you go into preferences, click on audio, right? You see a whole list there. Click on audio, and in the where it says microphone, make sure that your input is selected to the right thing.
Hmm.
Are you doing it, Lucy? Just nod once if that's the case, because I can't hear you. You are doing it, but you don't see any options there? Nope.
No. Should we just call her?
Yeah. Brendan, just send her a link. And so we can see her, keep the Zoom up, and then just call her on the phone, have her call in on the phone, and maybe we can hear the audio and see her. She'll be a little bit out of sync, but that'll be the way it is. So Brenda, will you send her something?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
All right. We'll get Lucy squared away. Lucy, you can just watch the show for now. And Lucy, of course, is the co-host of the AM Quickie. And there you can hear her, but not see her. And so on this show, you see her, but you don't hear her. And that's the way that we like to roll with that stuff.
Okay. She dropped from the Zoom. So,
okay. Well, Brendan, have her hooked back up on the Zoom and the other thing. In the meantime, let's talk about the, there is no coronavirus relief bill that exists at this point. Supposedly Donald Trump was going to do some type of executive action that he doesn't have the right to do. You cannot, Donald Trump does not have the ability to order the deferral of collection of Social Security taxes, which is what his plan was. This deferral is a horrible idea because, A, how are people going to pay this money back? If they don't pay it back, where is the money going to go from the Social Security Trust Fund? But he also, I don't think, has the executive authority to do this. You know, it's not like a question of executive discretion in terms of the IRS collecting it. It's going to involve more effort to suspend these payments than it would to continue to collect them. I think it would be easily challenged in court. But here is Fox News surprisingly admitting that Donald Trump is headed off on vacation. And for those of you who have diminished unemployment benefits, for those of you who have eviction notices, for those of you small businesses who've run out of the Paycheck Protection Program, for you student loan holders and working on deferrals, you're SOL because Donald Trump is on vacay. Play this clip.
There is no deal. The White House chief of staff says that President Trump will take executive action to act unilaterally. And that could come as early as today, possibly tomorrow. But the preference is still for them to cut a deal on Capitol Hill. But Sandra, any hope that the commander in chief may go directly to Capitol Hill or invite Pelosi and Schumer to the White House to try to hash things out at the last minute face to face? They're really not on the table because President Trump has already left Washington for Bedminster, New Jersey. Sandra?
All right. That leaves a lot of questions over what happens the next 24, 48 hours. Kristen, thank you.
Yeah, it does.
Ooh.
It leaves a questions. Lot of questions. Yeah. Now, on the phone, Lucy, you there? Oh, sweet Lord. Didn't we test the phone thing, right? Lucy, are you there?
If she's connecting over computer, it might be the same problem. Her mic connecting to Zoom.
Yeah, have her call in with her phone, Brendan. Because I cannot hear her.
Got it.
Boop, 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 boop. Or have her access the link via her phone. That might work.
I gave her both options.
Well, I want to save this for Lucy.
You want me to put her through?
Yeah. Lucy.
Hello.
Lucy.
Hi. My face and voice cannot exist at the same time.
I understand.
It's part of being an interdimensional being.
I know. Believe me, I've been through that many times. I mean, I grew out of that stage.
Yeah.
And I'm you know, I think over time you will learn how to both show up both in terms of your voice and in terms of your visage, as it were.
Well, you know, I've been taking a lot of hydrochloroquine, so I'm hoping that helps me.
Well, I mean, it's showing up in terms of your audio, but one of the side effects of hydro is that apparently your voice and your image cannot appear in the same place.
Yes. Yeah.
So Lucy is the co-host of the AM Quickie. You can hear her 2 to 3 times a week in the morning. Lucy, you've been great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for the work you've been doing. All right, let's what have you been doing during the quarantine? Have you been going out much?
I mean, I've just been, I've been using it basically as an excuse to indulge my worst antisocial habits. So I've been pretty much good. I don't have to go out a lot. I mean, I work from home, so it's like, it hasn't been a huge, obviously I haven't been, destabilized by it and the way a lot of people have. So basically I'm just, doing what I always do with a better excuse for it.
And you got a great setup there. I mean, except for that, it's not functional, but it looks really good.
It doesn't work. Yeah.
What do you do? Are you lifting weights every day?
I do some. I mean, those were aspirational. I got them. I was like,
they're big weights, Lucy.
They are. They're pretty big. Yeah. I was like, I see YouTube videos of like tiny women lifting, 300 pounds while they're doing a waltz, and I'm like, why not me? And the answer is I don't have the drive.
Oh, there you go.
but they are in the background of my shot now, so they're a good conversation piece. People think I might be muscular underneath the jacket. That's all I need.
And so it's basically working in that respect. let's go through some of these videos. I don't know. I mean, what is it? How have you been spending your time? You've been watching a lot of TV. I mean, what have you been doing?
Yeah, I've been actually working a lot. Like I haven't really stopped working.
You edit stuff, right?
Yeah, I edit stuff. I write. The only thing that's changed is I haven't been able to do stand up. Now some people are starting to do outdoor shows. I'm like, but the morality of that is kind of unclear. Like some people are like, never do an outdoor show. You're a selfish asshole if you do an outdoor show. And some people are like, they're trying to do them. So, I don't know what the common wisdom on doing outdoor shows is now, but.
The issue with let me just be clear. The issue with an outdoor show is that you're inviting people to come and get COVID outdoors.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like, I figure, obviously it's more risk than doing a Zoom show. So it's like, there's a built-in ethical issue. But
are you doing Zoom shows at all or no?
I haven't done a Zoom show. I haven't been able to bring myself to adapt to that particular change.
I find that to be, I would find that to be very, very challenging.
Yeah. Like, I just don't know. Like, I've seen some people set up, some people have been set up. I'm sure it's possible for it to be funny, but it's like the idea of everyone laughing on their microphone individually, I don't know. Seems a little dystopian, but then again, everything does.
I know it. Well, that's interesting. I didn't realize that there was a lot of like sort of moral discussions about outdoor shows. I mean, my sense is if everybody's wearing a mask and it's in a big enough area, then you're fine, I guess.
Well,
I mean,
right. Yeah. That's what I figured. Yeah. It's like, I think as much as obviously the right is way more of an actual problem in terms of just like denying that there's a pandemic, but there are definitely elements in any situation. There's always elements of people who are like everything will always be too soon. Like everything will always be too risky. I don't think there's a huge risk in doing an outdoor thing if you do it right.
Yeah, I guess that's a hard dilemma. It hadn't even occurred to me that might be going on. But all right, well, let's go through some videos that I guess you can watch. I mean, you can watch it. You can connect to the Zoom, right? Can't you connect to the Zoom and just not use your audio, just use your phone?
That would work.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, just do that so that we can see you and you can see the video that we're going to pop up. So you can follow along and comment with us. And we'll just see.
Okay,
maybe it could sync. Who knows? This is going to be a good experiment, ladies and gentlemen. This is the way we do it around here. This is the way we do tech. We just piece it together. One by one.
Our incubator.
Exactly.
All right. Yeah. Let me try to get that word in.
We're trying to ideate this right now and see how it goes. Here is a list of the speakers, incidentally, while we're waiting for Lucy to connect. Bernie Sanders and John Kasich will share a night in the spotlight, according to Politico. Both Clintons are slated to have prominent speaking roles at the all-virtual Democratic National Convention. Like, honestly? Wait, do we need both of them there? Do we really need Bill Clinton to speak? Who is he appealing to now? Oi, she hung up the phone?
Oh, damn.
Lucy, not so great on the technical stuff. She's very funny. But not so great on the technical stuff.
It's a good bit, I gotta say.
She's doing a good bit. Boop-a-doop-a-doop-a-doo. Elizabeth Warren will be speaking. Kamala Harris will be speaking. Jill Biden. Barack and Michelle Obama will be featured prominently. Kasich will appear on the same night as Sanders early in the week in a demonstration of unity. Ugh.
Oh, hell yeah. Sign me up.
Demonstrations of unity.
That's horrible.
I have a clip of Bernie and Kasich while we're waiting. Let me just pull this up here. Back in the day,
one from the 90s.
Yes. Nice. Yeah. People never change. It's only text I put in it, but it's right here. Oh.
And I think we've already taken some steps in this committee to trim back some subsidies that we think are not justified. And I also want you to know that I got this morning two copies of the Cato study that I intend to review over the weekend, and we'll look at it carefully.
Would there be a possibility? Again, the only point, I don't want to beat a dead horse here. You have made some cuts which are going to hurt a whole lot of people. There's no debate about that, correct? And obviously, you made those cuts because you think in the long-term best interest of America, we have to save that money. Now, you and I have a disagreement about priorities. I respect your sincerity in that.
There's your unity.
Yep, there you go. You are a heartless bastard who want to inflict pain on people, but I can tell you're sincere about it. And so, you know, okay, now we all know.
Agree to disagree.
We'll agree to disagree. Should not be psychopathic in the way that you treat other people. Well, let's just go to the phones then for a second. If we'll see what happened. I don't know what happened to Lucy. Calling from a 210 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Where's your unit?
Yep, there you go. You are a 210 area code. Hello? Well, watching the show.
It's like a musical accompaniment, I think.
Yeah.
MR Jazz.
Here we go. This will be interesting. Watch the scramble. 210.
Yeah, good afternoon. Good morning.
John from San Antonio. Wondering who was listening to the show. All right, glad to hear it.
Yeah. So it's been a phenomenal week for progressives. Cori Bush won a tremendous upset victory by beating Lacey Clay. Bush is the first Justice Democrat and is beloved by the progressive community. Here's a quote from Bush. We've been called radicals, terrorists. We've been dismissed as an impossible fringe movement, but now we're taking a multi-faced mass movement united in demanding change and demanding accountability and demanding that our police, our government, our country recognize that black lives do indeed matter. Last night, DSA Memphis and Mid-South endorsed Marquita Bradshaw pulled off the biggest upset in a primary in a long time. In the Democratic race for the Tennessee Senate, Bradshaw only reported raising $8,000 and it didn't file reports in the last two quarters for the SEC. While James Mackler, who was endorsed by Chuck Schumer's Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, raised $2.1 million. After the tragic murder of George Floyd, we've seen very effective protests. And then we saw great black candidates like Jamal Bowman, Mondaire Jones, Cori Bush, and now Marquita Bradshaw win primaries. Robin Kimbrough, who is also black, supports Medicare for All and a Green New Deal, finished second place in the Democratic primary for the Tennessee race. She received $87,846 votes, and Bradshaw received 117,345 votes. And on Tuesday night, a brand new Congress endorsed John Hoadley won his primary in the 6th District of Michigan.
I was going to ask you about Hoadley. Someone wrote in about that, about Hoadley. Did you know much about him?
Yeah, he's endorsed by a brand new Congress, supports Medicare for All, Green New Deal. You know, he's in a swing district. He's going up against Fred Upton, up and only won the district by 4.5 in 2018. And also, you know, this is the guy who Biden collected $200,000 3 weeks before the election addressing Republicans. Bernie should have hammered him more on that. But anyway, so Hoadley leads by 1 point in a Victoria Research poll conducted in early May. So I think he's got a good chance, and he joins the list of progressive candidates who are in tight races, which include Kara Eastman in Nebraska's 2nd, Dana Balter in New York's 24th, Mike Siegel in the 10th District of Texas, Donna Imman in the 31st District of Texas. And on July 14th, I called in and talked about the Siegel and Imman race. And the next day, he said I talked about the 24th District race. But I didn't. Perhaps you got confused because the Ryan Grimm article, was promoting Siegel and Candace Valenzuela, who won the race, and she's a good candidate. She doesn't support Medicare for All, but you know, otherwise she's a good candidate, backed by Elizabeth Warren, backed by the congressional caucus, the Progressive Caucus, who put a lot of money in her race, and she's leading in a couple of polls, and I think she has a good chance of flipping that seat. So I just want to talk a little bit also about, you know, how, you know, some of these races that people think are kind of impossible to win. I mean, you know, Republicans are, you know, obviously haven't learned the lessons of Herbert Hoover and how, you know, he brought them down for, you know, I would say probably 15 years after World War II, they started recovering slightly. And they just don't understand. And I hope that the American public is kind of, you know, show them that they have to have some kind of empathy with them or they're going to lose terribly. And so, I mean, you look at these races and the Republicans, actually, the senatorial races, people like, you know, Toomey, who won, and Ron Johnson, actually outperformed Trump in 2016. Now Trump is outperforming all of these senatorial races, Tom Tillis or McSally.
Yep.
I mean, the only one that's outperforming Trump is Susan Collins, and she's still, you know, on the way of
down 3 points, right?
Yeah. And so we see that flip, and that's an interesting dichotomy for me.
What do you think? So just to be clear on what's going on here is that the idea that it seems to me, if Trump is outperforming Tom Tillis, it seems to me that there is always people are just interested. There's a certain amount of Republicans who are just interested in a Republican. And then there are other people who will punish the sitting senator because they are too pro-Trump. Is that what's going on? I mean, how does that work?
I think there are people that kind of are put into the cult. They're Republicans, but at the same time, you know, they feel like, you know, they feel a loyalty for Trump. I don't really get it myself. It defies logic. But, I mean, this is happening, you know, all around. I mean, and the margins are pretty big. I mean, you look at especially Arizona and North Carolina, where, you know, the Biden's leads are, you know, not too big. I mean, they've been shrinking slightly, you know, 2 to 4 points. In both of those races, probably 2 points in North Carolina, 4 points in Arizona on a polling average. And you see Cal Cunningham and Mark Kelly, who aren't great candidates. I talked about that last year, how all of the, you know, these senatorial candidates are pretty bad, including Barbara Bollier, who won, or who nobody ran against her in Kansas. She actually was a Republican and was a member of ALEC. Now she's running as a Democrat. Yeah. But I mean, you know, I mean, hopefully they'll give in to pressure. I mean, you've talked a lot about that, but yeah, I mean, it just seems like in general, people are more disgusted with the Republican Party than they are with Trump. I mean, people, for whatever reason, you know, they still believe in Trump more so than the Republican Party. The latest YouGov generic ballot had Democrats up by 12 points. 12 points.
That's pretty high.
Yeah. And so I'm pretty happy about that. I was real happy about Bradshaw. I mean, it's just great to see. I mean, I know people are going to say, well, you know, she'll never win in Tennessee. And, you know, that may be true. I mean, she's going to have an extremely hard time. Blackburn only won by 11 points. You know, in 2018. And so I'm constantly seeing, you know, margins, you know, about a 5-point margin being shaved off from 2016 totals.
Well, you know, we'll get into this a little bit more as we get closer to the race, but I appreciate the call, John.
All right. Thank you very
much.
Thanks. Sam.
Bye. All right. I think we got Lucy back. So let's bring Lucy up on audio. Lucy, are you there? Lucy?
She muted herself. She's going to unmute herself.
Is she on the phone? Lucy?
Hello?
Hello, Lucy?
Hi.
And are we trying to bring up your image on Zoom? Yeah, here she is. Okay. So let's see if this works. I mean, we don't need to get the sound from the Zoom unless we do, but is your camera on? Lucy, is this the first time you've ever used Zoom?
Yeah.
There she is. There's a picture of Lucy.
Hello.
Talking on the phone. There you go. All right. Great. I mean, it doesn't look as good of a setup as you had, you know, before. Now, why are you putting your headphones on? Lucy, what did you do? What are you were just talking about? She hung up on the phone again.
No.
Lucy, are you pranking us? What are you doing?
It's like, who's on first?
This is unbelievable. Lucy's just A lot of people ask, like, why don't you have Lucy on the show? Well, now you know why. Now you know why. We were hesitant to have Lucy on. Let's
call him in again.
We were planning to have Lucy on for a long time. And
we said, okay, we want Lucy on the show. Let's wait 6 to 8 months to see if she's going to have like the ability to use Zoom or use a phone. And we thought 6 to 8 months would be enough, but apparently she needed a little more time. Lucy, you there?
Hello.
Hello. Okay. Now listen to me. Don't hang up the phone.
Okay. I'm here. I got it now.
You don't need to put your headphones on.
Okay.
Yeah, you can just listen via the phone.
Now I get it.
Yeah,
I'm firing on all cylinders now.
just look at the computer, but do not interact with it in any way.
This is fun. I've never actually done this before.
Yeah, it's actually working. I mean, it's perfectly syncing almost. I mean, it's not, it's not the same quality that we're used to around here, but we can deal with that. All right. So let's, Lucy, come on. Now we're going to have some fun. I know how much you love Charlie Kirk, but I have to say, Yeah, he's your kind of guy, but he's been a little bit off his, I don't know. I think he's trying to drive a show a little bit. But here is Charlie Kirk. This has been hard on everybody, but this whole COVID stuff is even harder on him.
There's an important point here that you're making. What's been so disgraceful in the entire virus reaction to here is, first of all, we don't talk about the costs of what we've actually done at all. We act as if it's nothing, but we act as if the lockdown was only an economic cost, where according to the data, according to the CDC director himself, more young people have committed suicide than died of the Chinese coronavirus. That's just incredibly tragic, and that should really be addressed. And so closing schools, I think, is a total and complete mistake, and I think it's hyper-political. I think that this is societal and cultural waterboarding. I think that they want to keep us under the water till we tap out and say no more. We're going to elect somebody on the other side that's going to get us out of this. And it's actually really incredibly demonic what has happened in our country, and I don't use that lightly, where we have people that are perfectly fine seeing human suffering because they think it fits their political agenda. And I think that is so incredibly backwards and awful, where they are basically like, yeah, it's, you know, like, for example, CNN has that daily death toll on CNN where it's just the only reason they are doing that is because they know it makes the current incumbent look bad. I mean, there's no other reason to do that. There isn't. You think anyone watches that and they think they get excited? It's like, it's of course not. Right. It's a propaganda campaign to get people deflated.
So there you have it. We're being subjected to cultural waterboarding, except for A, there's no doubt in my mind that we can go back and find examples of Charlie Kirk saying that waterboarding is not torture. But B, what does cultural waterboarding mean?
Yeah, I think it's cute that Charlie Kirk thinks you can tap out of waterboarding.
That's right.
Like it's a light BDSM play between consenting adults. That's a really interesting perspective on what waterboarding is like.
And it's also sort of the idea that this is like, you know, what's going on is demonic, as if like he really believes that this entire Chinese virus apparently has is being imposed upon us by the left or by the media.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, he hasn't gotten a haircut, and I want to know why he's not getting a goddamn haircut if everything's so safe.
Sam, he's clearly going for a beachy vibe.
It is stunning to me, though, that the guy is so confident about sending people to school. You know what I think Charlie should do? I think Charlie should open up a daycare. And he should just take there, or maybe he should start teaching these kids. It is amazing to me that they are able to bring themselves to do this. This is about as low as it gets, right? Or no?
Yeah, I mean, it's just like people who are, there's nothing grosser than a person who is you know, rational enough, like, it to understand that they have to, you know, cut risk for themselves and at the same time, like, willing to go out and publicly, you know, give their audience this, like, false sense of assurance, you know.
I'd be curious about looking up just how many teen suicides are happening, if there is actually a marked increase in teen suicides. I imagine it's very possible that there's an increase in suicides and commensurate one with teens, because there's been a lot of pressure here, but I have a feeling it is not equivalent to the tens of thousands that have died at this point. We're probably going to get to close to 200,000, within certainly by the end of the year, maybe more, depending on if the rate of death increases. But
yeah, and again, like, just another, you're just naming two social problems where the answer would be more funding for social services, you know, more funding for protective measures. It's like, you know, it's like one doesn't cancel out the other. It just, like, highlights how impractical and, you know, morally abhorrent your philosophy is on two levels.
Right. And I, you know, maybe Charlie Kirk has been out there talking about teen suicide for a long time, but I tend to doubt it. And, you know, where is his, what is he calling for? Just open up businesses? I mean, how is this supposed to, it is demented. They're demented. Here is, this is fun. Let's watch Fox and Friends talk about, I guess, the V-shaped recovery. Like, I don't know. Like, it feels like the V-shaped recovery has sort of left the building, unless, like, V's are just spelled a little bit, you know, just drawn a little bit differently, right? Because a V just goes like this. It doesn't go like this. That's more, that's not even a U. That's more of like a coffee filter.
It's cursive V.
Cursive V. Here is Fox and Friends. And they're still like, do you think that, is it too late for a V recovery?
And these are the questions Trump officials all day. Is it the V recovery still in the cards come fall?
Well, considering the headwinds they're facing from governors and others who want to seek to keep their people locked down. And what that does is it creates uncertainty for businesses which don't know whether to hire, rehire, to push, to reopen fully, because are they going to get shut down again? So we'll continue to watch these numbers.
The whole
good to see them
is
going
in
up.
That mode, isn't it?
Exactly. And it's hard to grow like this.
What does our future look like? We don't know.
But hospitality being destroyed, you can't get the airline business off its back because they've been down for obvious reasons. No one's traveling. There's all these quarantines from state to state, so you can't even say, I'm going to keep it domestic. Those are issues. If you have a restaurant, don't tell me you're doing well. And
clothing,
if you have
stores,
a comedy club or an entertainment venue, you are not in business.
Absolutely. All right. We'll we're going to dig into this after the break for sure.
Yeah. Lucy, do you get the sense that the reason why businesses are unsure of things because of the governors? Or do you think that maybe part of the reason why they're unsure is because people are afraid of dying in a pandemic?
What's crazy about why, I mean, one of the weird things about, like, I guess, like, existing in the media universe of something like Fox News is that, like, everything happens on a delay, kind of, where it's just like, now they're just talking about, like, well, how can we speed up this recovery? It's like, we were having this conversation months ago.
Right.
You know? And now it's probably like, people are uncertain. People don't know what's going to happen. It's like, you know.
Yeah, no kidding. The idea of, like, plane travel, like, folks can go traveling on planes. There's a lot of states you can go from, like, yes, it's true. You can't fly into New York from Florida, but you could probably go Florida to Texas. Everybody would be happy with that. I have a feeling there's probably not many people flying from Florida to Texas. I have a feeling there's not that many people flying, and I don't think it has anything to do with the governors. I think it might have to do with, like, people going, like, I don't think I want to be inside a closed space. like 6 inches from somebody next to me.
Yeah, it's interesting how it's like, it also like things just get divided into this like weird binary where it's like there are business people and there are people who are concerned about their health and they're in conflict with each other forever. And it's like there's no, like then there's no such thing as like a business owner who's concerned about dying. You know?
No, like, they live forever if you have a business. Yeah. You know, what's really also, you know, it's been difficult is all these governors, like there's people just don't go into saunas together anymore. None of the, you can't go into a sauna place. You forget it because of the lefties, they're so concerned about coronavirus that nobody can go into a sauna anymore. Here is, and this is, you know, like, look, here's a cop in Brooklyn. Look at this footage. This is more of just like this attitude. Like, this is like literally, like, I would bet every single dollar I have this guy's a Fox News viewer. Turn this.
Excuse me, can you wear your mask while you're inside?
Can you back away?
6 feet. Okay. Can you put a mask on?
I'm not getting it right now. Thank you.
You're what?
I'm not going to get it right now. I don't have it on me. Do you have an extra one?
Do you have one in your car?
No.
You don't carry a mask?
No, I usually do, but I always just come and get food.
Can't be in here without a mask.
Okay, thank you.
You're going to leave?
No, not yet. Let me order something and I'll step outside. Appreciate it, bud.
Oof.
I mean, why, you know, like, it's one thing to come in there and say, like, you know what? Honestly, I forgot my mask. I'll be really quick. I'll do this. Like, just show some measure of like, yeah, I understand. I screwed up, but look, I lost my mask. I think would have, you know, people have sympathy for that.
Yeah.
And he's just being a jackass.
Yeah. It's like, and it's the kind of thing where, you know, just the humility, which I wouldn't expect from a police officer in particular, but it's like the humility of like, just like, regardless of whether I think I'm in the right or the wrong, like I'm not welcome here anymore. I kind of get the reason for not wanting me here. I'm just going to leave. Maybe the next place will not call me out on it. Like, you know, it's like,
it's this type of, I mean, that just that attitude in general, it's just sort of like there's a cultural problem amongst a lot of cops, not every cop, right. I imagine, but I mean, just that attitude of like, it's not like this person's asking you to do something that he wouldn't ask, you know, any other guest in the store to do. It's just right. Like, have some like recognition of other people around. I don't know. That just seems like,
it's just cops and white women in BB shirts.
This is another, I'm sure you've been following that. I'm not sure you're aware of this, but, the New York State Attorney General, has filed civil suit against the NRA because they are chartered in New York. And, it seems like they have been appropriating their money that have been donated to them and spending it on stuff that's not appropriate. They have also been messing up their tax filings. Here is Jeanine Pirro trying to get right-wingers up in arms about this. I don't think it's going to work because my sense is that like the damage the NRA did was stuff that people didn't really... that I think that like the audience for this stuff didn't really fully grasp that it was the NRA. Like they watched Dana Loesch or they watched that guy who drinks his own urine. What's that guy's name? Dan, what's that guy's name?
Bongino.
Well, yeah, Dan Bongino. I don't know why he does that, but they'd watch those people and I don't get the sense that it was really like the NRA. It was just a conservative outlet. And certainly I don't think people saw the lobbying that the NRA did or the money that they took from industry. So I think just the organization itself, I don't think there's that much attachment to it in and of itself, but here's Jeanine Pirro trying to make that bridge that, like, if you get rid of the NRA, the Second Amendment is going to go away, even though you have a right-wing Supreme Court.
They're doing this, and there's an AG in Washington, D.C., who's joining in and says, I'm going to sue the NRA, too. Well, you know what? This is just an indication of where they're going. The next thing is it's going to be guns. They limit our magazines. They limit the number of bullets, et cetera, et cetera. And now it's going to be, we're going to dissolve the number one organization that speaks to gun, or for gun owners in the country. It is absurd.
Scary times, Judge.
Oh, yeah. Scary times.
Scary times.
Oh, the people who bankroll Dana Loesch and Dan Bongino and promote the selling of people-killing weapons. Scary times if they're not allowed to do that anymore.
Yeah, it's kind of like a strange... I mean, the whole idea of... the idea of the Second Amendment is like, you know, you can... against it or for it in theory, but it's like the idea of like how you advocate for that right, it is kind of inherently weird, because it's like, you know, at the end of the day you're asserting your right to have this product, and so like it creates these weird organizations like the NRA where it's like any attack on the corporations that distribute and create this product are now also part of that right. And so, like, any attempt to, like, rein them in or regulate them or anything is also an infringement. And it's, like, it's this weird kind of, like, extrapolation that, like, you don't see with, like, freedom of speech or freedom of religion.
Right.
Right.
It's like a Smith and Wesson. We're, like, the founding fathers.
Right.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the idea that, like, you know, anybody would, I don't know. I mean, I guess people would bemoan the loss of the ACLU in terms of free speech on some level. But I just don't, I just don't think the NRA had that type of relationship with people. I just don't, like, where yeah. were, in particularly, like, where were they? I don't know. Like, what, like, the whole gun thing has fallen apart because their whole argument has been to fight the tyranny of the federal government when they come for you with guns. And that's been happening and they're not saying anything. Like their right. greatest fever dream is coming true. And they're just going like, I'm not worried about it.
Yeah. It's like, if anything, the response has been to form these, like, on the most extreme end of the spectrum, like, if anything, the response has been to form these, like, gross little, like, paramilitary forces that are just, like, backing up Border Patrol.
Right.
And, you know, threatening immigrants, like...
Right, we've got these...
enabling, like, the worst...
We've got these guns because our Constitution and our founding fathers said you've got to fight tyranny sometimes with a gun. So when the government comes for me, unless I see the government really up armoring, in that case, I'm going to start my own militia and I'm going to ask them to deputize me. I'm going to be on their side.
Yeah, right. I'm just going to go out there and support that violent federal agency that was created in 2002. Yeah.
That's exactly.
I think Wayne LaPierre is going to dust off plan whatever they call it, Plan X or something, which is like run a Manchurian candidate who's basically Barack Obama too, to boost gun sales.
That, I mean, that would be, but I don't know that his organization is going to be around anymore.
Right. Hey, whoever's folks, next, NRA too.
Folks, I got to tell you, people are hanging on the phones. We're not going to get to phone calls today. I'm sorry. I apologize. We got to be done by 12:30. So, folks, we're not going to get there. So I would not hang on the phone any longer. I apologize. Monday we'll pick it up, but between all the tech issues and Lucy not being able to use a phone, like, she ruined the whole show. We couldn't do the phone. So, but
we had to make room for my brilliant slapstick routine, which was a commentary on modern tech.
There you go. You should cut that up as a YouTube and send it around to all your friends. And, like, you did the exact same thing, but just like put on like an outfit, like you were a mom. And it's like, I can't work the Zoom. I don't know. That's like a block. Like, you put that out there, you'll get like a sitcom deal out of that.
Yeah.
You could host Ellen. Yeah.
This is pretty funny. So Kelly Loeffler, she's running for the Senate in Georgia. There are two Senate races in Georgia this year because Isaacson's retired, right? So Perdue is running for re-election against John Ossoff. He's got a 4 or 5 point lead, enhanced by the fact that he communicated to people that Ossoff was a Jew, and that that's and apparently that was effective. Ossoff, not necessarily a great candidate. Loeffler is running against a guy named he's like a minister, like Burdick or something. And he's actually doing fairly well. And he is an activist. Kelly Loeffler owns partly a WNBA team from Georgia. And apparently the players have been wearing shirts and have been publicly encouraging people to vote for Loeffler's Democratic opponent. And here's Kelly Loeffler really taking issue with that.
Senator, here's who reportedly orchestrated this whole new campaign against you. The New York Times is reporting that one of your own players, Elizabeth Williams, said the idea to publicly endorse Warnock came from Sue Bird. Now, both Williams and Bird are executives in the Players Union. Top players also consulted with Stacey Abrams. What? Abrams joined the Players Union Board of Advocates last summer. So now Stacey Abrams, she has nothing else to do. She's involved in the this is just so petty. And it's just, I don't see how this brings more people into watching the WNBA. I think this turns people off. People want people to be treated equally and well, and, you know, want people to have full, wonderful lives. But this is just mind-numbingly easy, absurd at this point.
Well, you're right, because Stacey Abrams has endorsed my opponent, so it's blatantly clear that this is all about politics and not about the unity that sports can provide. I mean, I grew up playing sports. I think we all know the power that sports has to bring people together from all walks of life and to support people of different backgrounds and the tolerance that you get by being part of sports. And that's been totally eradicated here in this moment where, because I have a conservative voice, they want me out. They want to cancel me.
Silence.
And they're basically saying our sport's not big enough for conservatives. So I will always stand up for the conservative voice and for all Americans who don't feel they have a voice right now.
They're not kicking her out of the WNBA. They're just supporting a different candidate. This is so political, their support for my opponent.
Yeah. I wonder if she would feel it was political if they were all wearing shirts with her name on it.
I mean, I just can't understand. Like, are there people watching this stuff on Fox News going like, it is wrong? How come they can be like, that's their owner. She's their owner. She owns them. They can't express a desire to have someone run against her. And this is cancel. This is what cancel culture is. It's when you decide that you don't want to vote for the multimillionaire to be your senator.
First, they came for the owners.
And then they came for the really wealthy owners. And then they just stopped. Unbelievable. And Laura Ingraham, really, I feel like she's just running out of stuff to say. And so she just gets like even that much more sort of. It's all just, she's just doing like the all intonation show.
Right. Yeah. As soon as you find yourself saying, what, they have nothing better to do, you've run out of things to say, I think.
This all seems so petty that we've only dedicated 7 minutes for our national broadcast tonight. It's so petty that these players are wearing a t-shirt that we just want an opportunity to bring up as many African-American names of people that people might recognize on our show and just talk about that for 6 minutes and say they're against you and canceling you. I did like a whole show that would just sort of like actually just cop to that being what the show is. That would be fun, I think. Here is, sadly, I was supposed to host Bernie Sanders tonight on All In with Chris Hayes, but apparently there's been a technical problem and he can't connect up from Vermont. But I was going to talk to him about his one-time 60% wealth tax on billionaires who have accrued this money during the pandemic, right? Like, because, like, you know, you read these stories, like, I don't know, like Bezos has made, like, I don't know, tens of billions of dollars over the past couple of months. And Sanders is like, 60% of that, we'll take it to pay for healthcare. Here is CNBC talking about this. It's like, this is like hurting God almost.
I told you yesterday about a proposal by Senator Bernie Sanders to tax the wealth that billionaires have added to during the pandemic. The senator released that proposal yesterday. It would impose a one-time 60% tax on billionaire gains between March 18th of 2020 and January 1st of 2021. Those funds would be used to pay out-of-pocket health care expenses for all Americans for a year. If the taxes were calculated right now, based on the gains we've seen in the market, here's what some billionaires would pay. Jeff Bezos would be on the line for nearly $43 billion. Elon Musk would pay $27.5 billion. Mark Zuckerberg, well, he'd have to pay about $23 billion. And Walmart's Walton family would pay nearly $13 billion. Andrew, obviously, probably something that's a non-starter, but it's certainly going to be an exercise that has people running through what billionaires have made and where that money could go.
The other issue, by the way, and I'm sure other shareholders who might not otherwise be sympathetic with the Jeff Bezos would become sympathetic with the Jeff Bezos, is because he would have to sell his shares to actually pay right. the tax bill, in which case all of a sudden there would be an overhang on the stock. And people would get upset about whether, you know, the value of their stock is going to go down effectively because he has to sell his shares.
Well, and also just how much control you lose over a company at that point, too. A lot of these founders like to keep their company to make sure that they can continue to do it. Some of them can do it through a different voting share structure, but not all of them have that set up, and Amazon doesn't.
Right. That's true. That's actually very, very, very true.
Yeah.
Meantime, didn't Bezos sell like three...
Didn't he sell $3 billion worth of stock earlier this week? How much?
He sells down regularly to pay for his space explorations.
That's
typically
must be nice.
He's trying to find
that's what he said. When he sells the shares, that's what he's selling them for.
He and Elon Musk often talk about the reason that they do this in terms of resources is in terms of money at this point is literally to fund the other endeavor, which I've always found sort of fascinating.
Sure. Element.
Meantime, I don't know if you guys saw this story.
I'll tell you something. If you ever wanted to know, I mean, because obviously this is not going to pass and it's not going to become law, but if you ever want to know what the effect of a messaging bill is, you just witness it. Right? Like they're going like, you know, I guess we're talking about if Jeff Bezos would have to pay $42 billion, that means that he has made about $70 billion in this lockdown. $70 billion. And they're going like, but this would be hard. He'd have to sell his stocks. Oh, wait, he's already selling $3 billion a month of stocks to pay for his spaceship that he put up. Oh, yeah. No, this would be hardship on him.
I can't think of a person who's, you know, probably profited off of the pandemic more than Jeff Bezos. Like, you know.
Well, this the beauty of this is like the messaging is like, this is what a message bill is supposed to do. You force people to talk about it. And then that just in even slightly defending against it, you start to realize like how absurd this is.
Right.
I mean, he could, in 10 months, just in time for April, he could sell $3 billion of stock for 12 months, I guess, sell that $3 billion worth of stock. Instead of putting it towards his spaceship, that's his hobby, he could pay the taxes and we could get healthcare. I mean, $40 billion. What would $40 billion do in terms of like hospitals around the country providing healthcare for people? And then, you know, same with Musk, although he's got his spaceship too. Zuckerberg, like maybe he sells off this stock every now and then to just fund, like, you know, yacht club racing or something. I love it. I love it that they're forced to just make themselves look like idiots.
Yeah, and like that's what, you know, the moderates in the Democratic Party are generally missing is like, you know, any ability to like, you know, to attempt to push the conversation to the left, you know, it's just like, it's just a series of these kind of like just meek compromises, you know, that don't change the discussion at all. And, you know, on some level, that's the goal, I guess. But, you know, yeah, it really shows the contrast.
Sam, I think you're discounting just how much these guys like building spaceships. It's very important to them.
It's like cultural waterboarding to not let them build their spaceships right now during this. And now they need their spaceships even more than ever if this COVID keeps up. They don't want to catch COVID. All right, we got one more clip. Here is Mike Pence. One of the things that I think is really underestimated that in Donald Trump's victory in 2016, because I think that, you know, obviously it's been covered ad nauseum, all the different potential reasons why Donald Trump won. One that I believe has been completely underestimated was the open seat that Mitch McConnell, and certainly Mitch McConnell believes this, the open seat that Mitch McConnell essentially created on the Supreme Court when he wouldn't give a hearing to Merrick Garland. I believe personally that the Christian right was, I believe they made the difference possibly in the election, just the idea that there was a Supreme Court seat that could be opened. I mean, maybe not just the Christian right, but on the right, broadly speaking. And now they've sat two Supreme Court justices. Mike Pence is trying to, in some way, because he's the one, he's the God squad in the Trump administration, trying to sort of regain some of that energy from 2016.
Are you scratching your head a little bit on John Roberts? I mean, we're not going to call him David Souter at this point, but conservatives have had a track record of having some problems with Supreme Court justices that you thought were going to be a reliable vote. Or at least when I say reliable vote, I'm just talking about, you know, to adhere to conservative principles.
Look, we have great respect for the institution of the Supreme Court of the United States. But Chief Justice John Roberts has been a disappointment to conservatives, whether it be the Obamacare decision or whether it be a spate of recent decisions all the way through Calvary Chapel. It's a reminder, and I think several cases out of the Supreme Court are a reminder of just how important this election is for the future of the Supreme Court. We remember the issue back in 2016, which I believe loomed large in voters' decisions between Hillary Clinton and the man who would become president of the United States. And some people thought that it wouldn't be as big an issue these days, but I think that's all changed. The recent decision, and again, a narrow Supreme Court decision, striking down a Louisiana pro-life law that only said that doctors working in abortion clinics would have to have admitting privileges at local hospitals. That's a very modest restriction on abortion providers, but a narrow majority in the Supreme Court still said it was unacceptable. And I think it's been a wake-up call for pro-life voters around the country who understand, in a very real sense, the destiny of the Supreme Court is on the ballot in 2020. And that's why President Trump announced that he's going to publish another list of men and women from which he will draw any future appointments to the Supreme Court of the United States. He did that in 2016. He kept his word. He's going to do that in the fall of 2020. And in the next 4 years, he'll keep his word and appoint more principled conservatives to our courts.
Lucy, have you spent a lot of time with like hardcore Christian conservatives?
I have not. I mean, look, I've got some, you know, people in my family who are, you know, being Christian or, you know, born again Christian, evangelical Christian. You know, nothing like these people, but
These two guys sitting together seem to me to be the weirdest. Like, it's like there's such a weird affectation to the conversation. It's so strange.
Yeah. This is the 700 Club, right?
Yep. Or yeah, CBN or one of those things. Yeah.
They all have that kind of like droning. It's like they're trying to put you into a trance.
Sort of.
You know? So they can sell you bunker feed at the end of the segment.
I mean, exactly. And but there it is. I mean, they are trying to argue now that John Roberts is insufficiently conservative, complaining about the trap law, a decision that they made, and trying to draw him up that Christian conservative vote for Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think, like, you know, of the various different elements that you can look at to determine whether Donald Trump is in trouble electorally this year, there's one right there. There's just not the same sort of like impetus for the right to vote. The difference between there's an open seat and John Roberts is not as reliable as we thought he was. There's just like, you can, the messages are, you can, you know, one is, you know, pretty compelling and the other is right. Like,
yeah, I mean, it's amazing how quickly conservatives are like, you know, they'll give up the game in terms of just like the second, you know, one of their justices doesn't go for, you know, one tent pole and they're like death by a thousand cuts strategy. It's like, oh, they're disowned. You know, it's like I saw conservatives doing the same thing with Gorsuch, you know, when he sided with the majority on, you know, the LGBT rights issue. And, you know, it's just like maybe there's just a sense of, I don't know if like there really is a sense at this point of like, we got you in, you owe us, you know, but it's like, maybe there always has been, but it's like, they're really like wearing it on their sleeve now.
They're relentless too. That's what it is. Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's a relentless agenda they're pursuing, and they're just really good about playing the aggrievement card when it doesn't go exactly their way. And, you know, to their credit, the right is understands the implications of the Supreme Court far more than the left does. And to a certain extent, that's why we have a right-wing Supreme Court.
I just want to highlight one last thing from this clip. Did you see David Brody's face after Mike Pence announced that they were going to reveal a new list of conservative judges that they wanted to appoint? He got like a little titillated there.
Yeah, he was really excited to play this again. He was really excited. A second list.
Destiny of the Supreme Court is on the ballot in 2020. Mm-hmm. And that's why President Trump announced that he's going to publish another list of men and women from which he will draw any future appointments to the Supreme Court of the United States.
You know what that look honestly looks like to me?
Of men.
That looks like to me like, yeah, I know. You and I have been drawing up that list with our friends from the Heritage Foundation. Like, I bet, you know, like it strikes me like a guy like Brody could be involved in that. You know, he gets a couple of names on that list. He's super excited. There's the list.
These are two guys who like a good list.
All right. We got one more clip and then we're going to wrap things up. Here is, Ben Shapiro. I can't even make you gotta help me with this. I can't even tell where he's going with this thing.
This is a crazy lefty lady who was using all of the trappings and all of the hallmarks of woke culture in order to get ahead, in order to generate sympathy for an agenda that she was pushing. That says something about where the halls of power in America truly lie, does it not? You don't see a lot of people who are seeking power attempting to ape conservatives, like pretend to be a conservative. You don't see that a lot. You don't see a lot of people who want power attempting to be white, right? That's not, you don't have reverse Rachel Dolezals. And that is an indicator of where power lies in a society, right? During Jim Crow, it was a fairly common and horrific thing. I mean, horrifically that anybody felt that they needed to do this, that light-skinned black people would sometimes attempt to pass for white, right? This is a very, very, there've been a number of famous novels on this particular topic because white was power for a lot of American history. Well, now there are not a lot of black people masquerading as white people. But you will see a Rachel Dolezal attempting to be black. And here you will see a professor pretending to be a bisexual Native American woman. The halls of power are replete with the diversity crew. And that is where people are attempting to pander in order to get ahead, which says something about where America stands. It doesn't say that America is deeply intolerant of diversity. It says precisely the opposite, that we are so militantly in favor of diversity that we'll swallow any stupid thing put forth so long as you slap a diversity label on it.
Could someone refresh my mind about the Rachel Dolezal story? What was her attempt into the halls of power? How was she using her identity as a black person to get into the halls of power?
I think she was a like co-director of the Western or Eastern Washington NAACP, yeah. And she was an adjunct professor at a community college.
Okay.
So yeah, the August Halls of Power. Boom. Boom. Was that mine?
I don't know what that was. Something got, something was really loud there.
I would say that still more people probably passing as white than are doing Rachel Dolezal's in this country, even post Jim Crow, I think. And on a like a more subtle note, look at the way like people like, I mean, Cardi B, they lighten her skin tone in certain things. It's a very common, these sorts of skin color things are very common, and still the preference culturally is towards lighter skin.
They just did it in a congressional race, didn't they? So was it Cori Bush?
Yes, they darkened Cori Bush in a mailer that they were doing. You know, but the idea that this is the way you get into the halls of power, like, I don't know. Like, I don't know what constitutes the halls of power. I'm like, if you look at like the CEO, it's like, is the way to become a CEO of a major corporation in this country is to portray yourself as an African American woman? I mean, what are the halls of power? Is he talking about like, you know, some, I don't know, like, you know, TikTok thing? Like, what is it? Like, what is he talking about?
The Netflix Big Mouths writer's room is what he's talking about.
What kind of world do you make people where it's like, if you acknowledge, because there's some acknowledgement in there, and that whole confused spiel about like, about how like for a long time in this country, white was power, right? That's an acknowledgement of something that's been systemic in this country for a long time, but you can't just let that lie. So it's like, now it's like, no, I'm going to move the goalpost so that my metric for determining who's oppressed is like, who's masquerading as who, right? It has nothing to do with systemic policy, with a policy or anything systemic.
Well, I'd also like to know, like, where does he mark? Like, if he acknowledges that in this country, that the white meant power, when did that end exactly in Ben in Ben Shapiro's mind? Like when did that end? Was it the Voting Rights Act? Is that when whites lost all their power in our society? I'm curious what he would say to that. Like, was it just like all of a sudden when, you know, I don't know, the Cialis's commercials, you know, featured a black guy.
Whoa.
Wait a second.
I think it ends Rachel Dolezal declared martial law.
I mean, guys, Justin Trudeau did wear blackface an awful lot, and he is prime minister.
Boom.
So I don't know. Maybe he has a point.
Checkmate, Ben.
Jeez, Matt, what do you do? What are you doing? Are you moonlighting over at Tucker Carlson's show too?
Yeah, and I have word that Dolezal is on Biden's shortlist for VP too.
Unbelievable. I mean, I do think that there is like, there has been a shift, but I think it's really hard to argue that white people don't have the dominant power in our society. I mean, it is true that, you know, there is at least a concept that black people have the right to vote in this country. Now, of course, it can be abridged quite easily via, you know, various mechanisms that that Republican controlled state governments have been working on, But I'd be really curious as to when, according to Ben Shapiro, the white people lost the power in this country.
Right. Like, if anything, you know, these examples that he's pointing out are, like, to me, they're actually more evidence that white people, you know, in addition to the power and the privilege that they've had, like, historically in the country, they're also using that. It's like, they're also managing to find a way to claim some of the benefits we've set up for people who have been historically oppressed. Like, they're also finding a way to kind of get in there, right? Like, the Elizabeth Warren example, if anything, is an example of that, right? Of, like, a privileged white woman trying to get, you know, affirmative action benefits on top of what she's already benefited from.
I don't know if she ended up getting those benefits or not, but yes, I understand the dynamic you're talking about. All right, well, listen, we're out of time, folks. Really apologize. We're doing a 20 minute shorter show, and but Lucy, this was great. Someday we would love to combine both your voice and your image and have you back.
It's gonna happen.
But folks can check out Lucy on AM Quickie. Well, this week you're doing what? Tuesday, Wednesday. I'm doing Monday, Thursday, Friday. Is that it?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. Well, check out Lucy takes the lead on 2 days. I take the lead on 2 days, and then we switch the third day back and forth. Lucy, thank you so much. It was really fun. I'm sorry it took it so long to get you on here. We got to do this more often.
Yeah, totally. Thanks. This has been fun.
All right. Good luck with the weights. All right, folks, we will be back here on Monday. Matt, Brendan, good job this week. Jamie, good job this week. See you on Monday.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know.